Thank you, Ian. I see Ian's left. obviously nothing to learn from me. I feel like the chap who follows the Lord Mayor's show. You've had these brilliant presentations with slides and so on, and now you get boring old lawyer talking in general terms. And I might say, when Ian refers to his wife, it's important to say that her name is Helena Kennedy. It is known that her husband is named Ian, so I bask often in the assumption of others that I am married to Helena. That isn't the case, and it's her good fortune as well as Ian's. I've been asked to talk about research, and I'll back away from these wonderful presentations you've heard, because my interest is in the application of general principles of ethics. And as Ian has said, and what I'm saying now is what I have put together as I've listened to people, so I've tried to create a story for you. And as Ian rightly said, when we think about research and research ethics, or the ethics of research, we usually think about drugs and trials and randomized control trials and so on. And we look for ways of establishing knowledge and then precedents which we can then use, relying upon the fact that we can take another step. And surgery, as Ian rightly said, surgery historically has stood outside this tradition of research in the way that I have just described it. Whether it's we'll try another procedure. I mean, when I was growing up in this field, you'd read an article in The Lancet which was said, we've just tried, Ian Back, you've missed most of the stuff. I used to read, yeah, absolutely, for your circumstances. I used to read a paper in The Lancet that might say, we've just tried, and I exaggerate, we've just tried to remove the appendix through the shoulder blade on six separate occasions. On none of those occasions did it succeed. We therefore recommend that you don't use this procedure in the future. And that masqueraded as, if you like, variations on the theme of research. And that was as regards trying things differently. As regards a new procedure, and many of the things that we'll be talking about in the next 5 or 10 minutes are in fact new procedures, what we had is people deciding to do a new procedure if they were surgeons, as Ian rightly said. He mentioned that I chaired the inquiry in Bristol, and pediatric cardiac surgery involved operating on something about the size of a walnut, a little baby's heart, and there was a procedure which was well known, called in the United States and in some other centers, called a switch operation, which is enormously complex. And it was decided by the surgeons there that they would do a switch. So they went to watch it done in Birmingham, where there was a very, very distinguished pediatric cardiac surgeon. One of them was very diligent. He even asked whether he could have a video of it, and then did it. There wasn't any sense that he had trained initially in Alabama and had done surgery on pigs and so on, but there was no substitute but to just go in and have a go. And tragically, his success rate was very poor, and it led to one of the allegations of that these young children were not properly cared for. So, and I had in Bristol, I was met with concepts such as, for surgeons, the idea of a learning curve. Now, I backed off. I mean, you're familiar with that expression. That for us surgeons, there's a kind of learning curve. That we do one or two, and then we get slightly better. And, of course, if I was the patient, I'd be quite anxious to know where you are in the learning curve before I am subject to that. But you were very rarely introduced to that information. I asked whether we could find some other way. And someone wrote a book, a very distinguished man called Powadi in the United States, where he said, you know, we can never get away from the learning curve. Well, I said mentally, made a note to myself, there's another surgeon talking, because I think we have to do a little bit better than that. And what Ian is representing and what this organization is representing is one way of doing a bit better than that. And surgeons were not irresponsible about learning. But what they tended to do, the better ones, was the use of audit and peer review. It was prospectively, we've done this, and we meet together and compare, rather than planning beforehand and randomized controlled trials and whatever. It was post hoc audit, which had its merits and was exceedingly responsible. When it was done by the Society of Cardiac Thoracic Surgeons, since 1973 they had their own register and they did meet, but it was a bit sort of internal, and the patient never got a look in to say, how am I figuring in where this process is at? So that's my first introduction, that we're in not only new territory as regards what is being done, but we're in new territory in the wholehearted embrace of the notion of research, led by Ian. And it's an ambitious program of research, including, although you, David, said it's difficult to do randomized controlled trials in this form of surgery, you said, because you couldn't compare it with psychotherapy. I think it is possible to do randomized controlled trials internally within the process of doing different forms of surgery. And I don't have too many problems about conducting research on what we could call established surgical procedures, variations from them. And there aren't usually, in ethical terms, many problems in research terms, in ethical terms, as there are in any other form of research. I think what you really need to be persuaded of is that there's a real absence, a legitimate absence of knowledge of which of the various variations. We're talking about variations rather than the leap into the new. I'll come to that in a moment. I'm going to divide variations on the existing leaps into the unknown. And as regards the variation, which you basically are talking about, I don't think there are major moral problems or ethical problems that we haven't come across before. You've got to have a real absence of knowledge, so that you can legitimately say to your patient, I don't know. It might be this, it might be that. I mean, they're both all right, that neither of them are going to be really bad, but we need to know which is better for you and for the world at large. Secondly, you ought to have done as much practice, experience, whatever, away from patients as you possibly can, whether through simulation, whether through animals, whether through anything else, and the use of modeling is clearly one of the ways, imaging is one of the ways of doing that. And thirdly, you must, as a surgeon, be prepared to accept that what you are historically doing might not necessarily be the best way of doing it. And that's this cultural acceptance that Ian was talking about, to know that he talks about hernia. NICE, NICE, the National Institute of Clinical Excellence, produce guidance on how to what is the optimum way of doing a hernia, repairing a hernia. And then there was a study. Not one surgeon in Hull followed the NICE guidance, simply because they didn't do it that way, and they were bloody sure they weren't going to do it any differently from the way they'd currently done. This was despite the building up of a body of knowledge based upon the Canadian Centre and other, about how to do hernia. So first of all, you've got to have this sense of a real absence of knowledge. Secondly, some prior experience in whatever simulated way. Thirdly, a preparedness of the surgeon to accept that there might be variations in results, and to accept the idea of randomization. And then you need the patient, and the patient's got to know that, A, they're in a trial, research, piece of research. Usually that means that they're going to be better looked after than otherwise, historically and factually, because they're more closely monitored. It's better to be in a trial, as it happens. Secondly, They've got to know it's randomized. They've got to understand what randomized means, rather than you picked. There was a famous story of the woman who was in a randomized double blind. You know what I mean by double blind? No, neither the doctor nor the patient knew. She was which drugs they were. It was a drug. And she said halfway through they had to switch. Some, but not all. Was completely blinded. And she said to her doctor, she said, "You've changed my drugs, haven't you?" He said, I honestly don't know. It's just a design so you wouldn't, we don't, none of us know. She said, "I know you've changed them." "You know, I honestly don't know. It's all part of the trial." She says, Oh yes, I know you've changed them, because the first lot, when I flushed them, they went all the way down. These lot float." So they have to understand they're part of a trial and that it's randomized. And then they, as regards surgery, is another thing you have to consent to. Apart from you're knowing in your trial, you know it's randomized, you have to recognize that there's a degree of irreversibility in surgery, which doesn't apply as regards drug tests. So there's that much more of an engagement, what Ian called an alliance. And then the idea also that you really need to know the risks. And the risks won't be particularly any greater than what you're familiar with otherwise, but you need to know if there are any risks of this, which may be minor, as compared with this, which may be minor but different. Do you understand? Because you're the one deciding, and if you're a ballet dancer and someone's doing something that might affect your balance, it's that much more important than if you're someone who isn't, like someone like myself, who's not given generally to ballet dancing. And then, so these are the things that you need, the standard stuff you're all familiar with if you've been into the ethics of research. And lastly, you need to have stopping rules. Do you know what I mean by stopping rules? When you're pretty sure that one thing is better than the other, you need to be able to stop and say, actually, this is better than t'other. And that's all standard stuff. What I'm now interested, am I doing all right for
time? You're fine.
I explained that Helena and I were not married, although my name is Ian. I got some sympathy. What about steps into the unknown is what we're asking now. How do we get from the speculative, this extraordinary range of possibilities, including that last possibility of architecturally designing something which then might even obviate you as a surgeon, other than as a kind of lift this bit out and put that bit in sort of thing. Most remarkable, imagine, although it will take stages to get there, perhaps. Speculative to the accepted. Okay. First of all, this isn't a new problem. Remember I said at the outset that we look for precedents. We look at, is there any experience of having done this before? It's human nature. Blimey, when we first started heart transplants, or kidney transplants, 1954, was it in the Women's Hospital in Boston? First kidney transplants on twins. That was such a leap into the unknown. They'd done the work on pigs. They'd done the work on animals. The best work had been done by a man in Stanford, but he was much more cautious than the man who ultimately did the first heart transplant, Christian Barnard, in South Africa. And in a sense, that was a surgeon taking a leap, and then the rest of us backing up and say, well, hang on, how do we mediate? How do we get into this so that we protect the patient, who feels very vulnerable, but we also protect the emergence of a body of knowledge, which is what Ian was most anxious to make sure that we understood, the emergence of a body of knowledge, which we can rely upon. And the central issue is, in my view, the patient and the patient's agreement to take part in this adventure. And that's what it is. And again, that's not a new phenomenon, to take part in holding the hands of the medical advisors to take that leap into the dark, into the unknown. I chaired an inquiry into what is called xenotransplantation. which now is going to be completely bypassed by, that's the involves the use of animals' organs to transplant into humans. It would have an enormous implication, and that was why it was described in the city as a $5 billion a year industry, because everybody would need cyclosporine for the rest of their life. So there was a great deal of interest in that area of research working. And I did the, chaired the inquiry and found that there were real concerns about what I learned to call porcine endogenous retroviruses, which, if you ask me what they are, I think they're to do with viruses which pigs might have, which live in the RNA and therefore quite difficult to get rid of. And so I recommended we not use it, but it was xenotransplantation. It wasn't, hasn't been taken up in this country. But what is interesting is we also thought about how you would do some trial on that, because you're asking people who otherwise can't get access to an organ, for whatever reason, we don't have enough in any context, except perhaps livers, to have a pig's organ that might have a endogenous retrovirus that might cause a plague like HIV, but might be completely innocuous. And we developed all sorts of things whereby the person would have to consent to be quarantined, not to have sex except in a, where if it was a male being protected by use of a condom, so there wouldn't be a to lead a very cloistered life, to be monitored almost incessantly by the team, because this is a developing, and people were prepared to accept that. Because, you know, as Maurice Chevalier once said, it was a famous cabaret artist, when he was asked what it was like to be 80, he said, well, given the alternative. and it's not dissimilar from that. It's where you are. And patients can be, as long as they're not exploited, as long as they're not taken advantage of, there will, and as long as there aren't the group of patients who will volunteer for mutilation because that's where they are, you have to be, you have to deal with that. And David shakes his head about that proposition, but I only raise it as a theoretical proposition. So when I apply that fact that it's not new, we are familiar with leaps into the unknown, and we have devised ways, structuring ways, whereby people can consent against the background of very severe restriction and against the fact that they might die without even waking up. Applied to surgery on the face, applied to tissue engineering, and in my view, the following falls out as a theoretical construct. First of all, we need to know, and David's work was very interesting on this, whether we can be clear about the indications and the assessment for acceptance of the procedure. That's a first step in terms of consent. You have to ask the right people for consent. Will the indication, are they the sort of person who will be positive and so on and so forth on what you were talking about? And that seems to me to be an area where we have very little knowledge, and where there is a need for the, as David put it, the psychologist to be part of the surgical team. The second is, once we have that element of consent, the next element of consent is consent to the procedure as it is understood, and what is going to happen to me, where are you going to do it? And that means those subset of problems: have you done it before, do you know, have you practiced it, what, to, as far as you know, are the risks. So far so good, the indications and the procedure itself. And then I think we're in partly your territory and partly your territory. Because we want to know, if I'm going to consent as a patient, I want to know what are the outcome, likely outcome, what am I agreeing to? And those outcomes need to be divided between physical outcomes, what's going to happen to me, what am I going to look like, and psychological outcomes. And they need to be teased out, and as much as we know now, and the more we can research those as a separate area of research, the more we will privilege the patient in being able to go on that journey with us. So outcomes physiologically, physically, and psychologically, and then not only outcomes in the short term, but consequences in the long term. What is this going to mean for me as a person? And of course, that we can't answer, but we can, using people like David, provoke that dialogue, which is a dialogue really about the vision the person has for him or herself, and the extent to which what you have in mind as the surgeon will approximate or otherwise. If you say, it'll be great, but you'll never be able to go out the house as a long-term consequence, that's not very attractive. But it is attractive if you're otherwise dead. So that very much is patient-centric, that notion of consequences and outcomes. So there you are. That's a hierarchy of things that, not if you're doing the kind of research that Ian's talking about, which is, I think, relatively standard and not difficult, provided the surgeon accepts, provided you do the randomization, provided you do the other things. But the leap into the unknown, who gets it? Do you know how to do it? What will happen to me psychologically and physically now and in the long term? What are the consequences? And each of those calls for independent research to the extent that you can do it. And there are precedents. You can take people from the Second World War who were victims of the Holocaust. When they came out, what views they had of what had happened to them and also what expectations they had for themselves and how you could try and rebuild a life for them in the light of what had happened to them. There are lots of precedents around, and that's what you try and build on. Thank you very much.